Today's date is May the 21st, 2012. My name is Jonathan Gerland. I'm with Mr. Ben Weber at the History Center in Diboll, and we're going to do an oral history today. We're going to talk about several different things, I think. His time during World War II, and specifically being a guard at some of the German POW camps, and also maybe baseball and softball after the war here locally, and maybe a few other things. But Mr. Weber, if you would, let's just begin. Maybe we'll sort of set the stage with telling us when and where you were born.
Well, I was born in New York City, in the heart of New York City. Everything is goes by numbers in my day, and I was born on 161st Street and 3rd Avenue in the Bronx.
And when was that?
And that was in 1924, June the 30th.
June 30th.
Yes, sir.
1924. What did your parents do? Did your father, what was your father's occupation?
My father was an interior decorator. In those days, that's what they called the painter, because it wasn't just a matter of like putting paint on the wall. They did decorations and then painted those in different colors. So it was very artistic on his part.
Well, did he work for himself, or did he work for a business?
Yes, sir, he worked for himself.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Sure did.
What are some of your earliest memories growing up in the big city?
Oh, one thing that I always enjoyed when I was there, and just a kid, playing handball. I don't know whether that's a thing down here. It's a hard rubber black ball, and you got to get it against the wall, and it's quite a thing. I think a lot of them now use rackets for that kind of stuff, but I did that, and I enjoyed it. I also enjoyed going to the they had the playgrounds. They only had the playgrounds in those times at the schools. And there'd be certain times they would lock the gate and you couldn't get in, so we'd climb over it. And that's where I first learned to do different things.
Did you play any baseball?
I played stickball.
Stickball.
Yeah, and it's still a game up there. And there was a great outfielder for the Giants, and that's how he got into baseball, was playing stickball. And anyway, what was his name? Willie... But anyway, right now I can't think of it.
You're not talking about Willie Mays, are you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, center fielder for the Giants.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, that's some of the stuff I was able to do.
Well, how did you get down to this part of the country?
Well, I got into the service.
Okay.
I had to fight my way to get into the service, but I got into the service and.
How do you mean by that?
Well, I was...
You joined too young, or...?
Too young, but I only weighed about 102 pounds, and I think the limit was 112. So every time... there's a place called the Battery in New York, and down there they had all the different services lined up. I started first going to the Navy, and they told me they couldn't use me. Then I went to the Marines, and they said, we sure can't use you. And Coast Guard, I went to every service that was down there. Went to the Army, and they said, well, we really can't use you, but I'll tell you what you can do. If you really want to get in the service, there's a method. And I said, do anything I can to go in. And he told me, you go to the draft board and tell them you want to volunteer, but you'll have to have your mother's signature to do that. And I went ahead and got my mother to sign it. After 3 or 4 weeks of battling it, took it back, and they said that that I could get a number and be called, even though they normally didn't do those things. And what would happen is that the next man that was going to be called and go into service, I would take his place. And that's how I went into the service. And the man that I took the place of, He never went in the service. He wrote me letters thanking me and all that kind of stuff. I think he had two children.
So the war was already going on at this time.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you remember where were you when you got the news about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
I was sitting in a movie house, and I had already applied, tried to get in, and that's when I went back down to them when Pearl Harbor was bombed. It was a shock. My father was alive at that time, and he had served at what they call Schofield Barracks on Hawaii. And he was very impressed with how much the damage was and how many ships were in there when they shouldn't have been.
So your father was serving?
He had served in between World War One and World War Two.
In between, okay.
Yes.
Okay. So you got the news while you were in a movie house, which was kind of a...
Well, they stopped the movie.
Stopped the movie.
Yeah, they stopped the movie and announced it. And
would have been late Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening. I guess the attacks happened in Hawaii early Sunday morning, so I guess it would have been much later in the day.
I don't know exactly what time it was, but it was a shock. And then all of a sudden, you know, everybody said, well, if we're going to do this, I'm going to go in the service. I'm going to do this. And then after things calmed down, they think better of it and a lot of things different, you know.
So when did you join up? When did you finally get into the Army?
I got in there in 1942.
42,
November.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And where did you do your basic training?
I did it in the same place that I went to. It's called Camp Upton. It's not there anymore on Long Island.
Okay.
And I did all my basics there. And I have a very strange story that I don't think most men put up with. But I got through at my basic, and then they put you in a tent, what they call a parallel tent, a big tent where a lot of men can...
What kind of tent?
A tent, a parallel.
Parallel?
It's, it's actually a big, long tent.
Okay.
And they say, well, you'll ship out from here. Well, 3 days went by, and everybody else was gone, and I was still in the tent by myself. And then they'd bring some more people in there. And this went on for about 3 weeks, almost a month. I never got shipped out. And I always kept getting put on kitchen duty. You'd get up about 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and they were waking me up 3, 4 o'clock. And I'd say, well, am I on this stuff again? And they said, yeah. And I said, why am I on it all the time? And they said, have you ever looked at the end of your bed? It says Kitchen Police KP on it. I said, I'm going to have to be smarter in this Army if I'm going to be all right. But anyway, after a while, they finally come and got me and put me on a truck with other men. Took us down to the railroad station, lined us up, and this is the officers, there were three officers, and they came down to see what kind of material they were going to get. Got to me, and he said, I can't use you. And I said, why not? He said, well, you're too small, and you just don't fit the thing that we need. And I said, do you mind telling me what it's going to be? He said, well, it's going to be a military police escort guard. You're too small. Well, anyway, and he said...
What size were you then? How tall are you?
Well, it was the weight. I didn't weigh but 105 pounds.
105, the weight.
And I was probably about 5'2". Not very big. And all the guys, when I looked down the line, all of them were like 5'8", 5'9", some even 6 foot. Anyway, he went to walk away, and I said, sir, I said, I have put up with a lot. And I said, I can do the job. If you let me go, I can do whatever you need me to do. And he said, well, how tough are you? I said, I boxed. Is that good enough for you? He said, what did you do? And I said, I boxed in the PAL. and that's the Police Athletic League. And he said, did you win everything? I said, yeah, I won every boxing thing I'd done. And they said, what'd you win? I said, well, I got 3 Golden Gloves, and I still have them. And he said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you a shot. And he said, I'm going to take you into this unit. The first time you screw up, though, he said, you're out. And I don't know where you'll go. You may go to an infantry unit. You could go anywhere. But I'm going to do it. Anyway, and I stayed there, and I said, okay. They put us back on the truck and took me right back to where I was at to start off with. And then that's where I took my basics. And I took all the firing of different guns, sub-Thompsons and everything. More shotguns than anything else, because that's what we were going to use rather than rifles. Anyway, they called me in one day and they said, we're going to make you cattery. And I don't know whether they ever heard that word. Cattery is what they do for people that are stationed permanently somewhere on a training base.
Spell that?
I don't know what I can spell. Cattery. And that's how I'm saying it right.
Not cavalry.
No, cattery. It means that you're stationed on that base permanently, and you can come and go as you please.
Okay.
You had a pass, but you could do whatever you wanted to do. And you were training these men as they came in 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them went only as much as 4.5 weeks. But that's what you'd done. You trained them. You trained them how to march. You did it all. And then they said to me, well, we're going to do this. And if you'll see, I hadn't been in there very long. They made me corporal. And just think, I was a corporal, and these guys are 28, 29, you know. And the youngest was 2 besides me. And I said, I'm going to do this. But I said to myself, what am I going to do if I fail? And they fixed it where I didn't, I guarantee it. They taught me. They worked me over. And I was a boss sometimes. That's what I thought, you know. Not really, but I thought I was a boss. But anyway, and that's how I got in the midst of it. That's why I gained a lot of respect, because I'd done my job and I'd done it very well. And then they moved this over to a place called Miller Field, and that's on Staten Island. And then that's when the prisoners were coming in on Fort Wadsworth. Fort Wadsworth. And
these are German.
These are Germans. Okay. And Italians.
And Italians.
And Italians. You had both of them. And then they said, that train's going to be yours right there that's backed up. And I said, and what are we going to do? Where are you going to transport them? You're going to start doing that. And they hooked 2 what they call lower and upper berth trains, where you have a place where you can sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had a kitchen car on it, which was just an open car that they cooked on. And anyway, we got the first load of them. We load them up, and I thought it was going to be a picnic. It was not, but anyway, and the men that I had trained was there with me. And you know, when you train men, you're not a sweetheart. You really, you know, you got to really dig in, and a lot of them may not like you because of the way you talk to them, make them do things. And but anyway, the guys were very good to me. And I set the guards. I was one of the non-coms that would set the guard wherever they're going to be stationed, on a platform, shotgun, throughout the train.
Non-commissioned, is that what you mean,
yes,
by non-com?
Okay. Yeah, non-commissioned. And anyway, and we took off. And I believe the first place that we dropped them off was in Tennessee, and I believe it was outside of Memphis. There was a camp. And Then when we went back, we were free. I mean, you know, we didn't take anybody back or nothing like that. There was nothing to do. They cooked for us, and we went back. We went right back to Staten Island. And then we started going to this Fort Wadsworth and going there. Every time we came in, we had to go right over there, clean up, take a shower, go over there, start loading them on another train.
More German.
Yeah.
Prisoner.
Yeah. Now, I had some Italians that we took to Florida. I don't know why they went there, but they went to Florida, and the camps were just opening up at that time. Anyway, I did that, and I did it for almost a year. I rode the trains. And one day they said, well, we're short on some of the camps that we're trying to open up, new ones. And that's when I got down here
to Texas
and stayed. Well, I first went to, I didn't stay but 3 days. I first went to Florence, Arizona. And we took the prisoners off, and they were Italian, and we took them off, and we stayed there for a while because the people, the guards that were there were shorthanded. So I stayed 3 days till another company came in. And then we wound up over at Huntsville. And we would get...
Was that your first camp to visit in Texas?
Oh, no. No. I went to one that was already in Center. It just opened up.
In where?
Center. Yeah.
Okay.
Center. I'll be more precise. Am I slurring?
No, that's fine. It's just...
And one up in... And then we opened one at Fannin in Tyler while I was here. We did a few things around, you know. We didn't just stay at the camp. In other words, when they brought another company in there, then we split it up and we had time that we could go out and do service. Like we'd have to march 12 miles and back, that kind of stuff. And we'd have to redo the camp in a lot of areas. Maybe the barbed wires and that, they didn't string them just right, but we'd have to help and do that kind of stuff.
So were you ever stationed at a camp for any
time? Yeah, over there in Huntsville. They call it Huntsville. But it was between it and
Riverside.
Yeah.
Okay. How long were you there?
I was there about, it was warm when I got there, and there was ice on the road when they were wanting to move me.
Okay.
And so I was there probably 6-8 months.
Okay.
Actually, I think we could have stayed there, but, you know, the prisoners at that time still believed that they were going to win the war. So when they got into those camps, they set up kangaroo-type judging on a person. Their people, not us. And it became quite a deal trying to keep those things separated. Anyway.
Was there a routine at the camp? Was the routine?
Yeah, the routine was that before they decided to let them go out and work, They had to go back into the back part. Was a great big area for doing soccer and things like that. And we let them go back there, and then we'd have to do the towers back in the back to keep, well, you know, where to keep where they were supposed to be. And anyway, we done that, and I took them out. I took a few out and got them to work. I was the only guard that took six of them out. And there's a stone quarry in over there in Trinity. And I took them over there where they could chip these and make blocks out of it so that we could use the blocks for the entrance of the camp and things like that. It wasn't for beautifying, but it would just give it an in and an out area. I took them there, and I brought them back at lunchtime, and then I took them back out. And they asked if they could do this all the time. And I said, well, I'm not the guy to tell you that.
But could they speak English?
There would be some, yes.
Oh, okay.
Actually, most of the ones that we had there were not true Germans. They were Czechoslovakians that had taken into the service and Germans. There was a few of each, you know, that they had conquered or done whatever with. Now, these people are coming out of North Africa after Patton kind of whooped up on them a little bit. And Rommel, they were all Rommel's troops. And, you know, he left and he went over to Italy. And these guys just started giving up. And so we got overwhelmed with so many prisoners. And that's when we shipped them back on the boat, put a big red cross on the side. And they went to different camps. We were not the only company that done this. There was probably three or four companies that were doing it everywhere.
What company? What's the identification of your company?
353rd MPEG.
Okay. MPEG. EG. What does that
stand for? Military Police Escort Guard.
Military EG. Police Escort Guard.
Yeah. And anyway.
Go ahead. When you took the six to work in the quarry,
yeah.
How many of you were there, guards? How many guards? Just you. Okay.
Right.
Now, did you assign them to civilians that were working there?
There was a guy that was a supervisor.
Okay.
Yes, and he came out, and he explained to me what needed to be done. And you even if you can't speak, I speak a little German, so nothing great, but a little more probably dirty words than anything else. But you can convey what you want them to do, and if they're willing to do it, they will. You can walk in amongst them and show them what you really need done. So this supervisor of the quarry, he showed them should be done, and then set them aside over in one place.
So other people, Americans were there working also, right?
Yeah, there was. Okay. I don't know how many they had there, but they
so
gave.
So it was an ongoing operation.
Yes, yeah,
and
yeah.
The Germans were just brought there.
Yeah, well, but they needed what they were needing more people to work,
right.
But everybody was gone, you know,
right.
In the service, and the way the thing they used was like a hatchet. But a flat blade hatchet,
mm-hmm.
You know, it'd be like this, and that hatchet was maybe about that wide or maybe more, and it was sharp, and that's what they chiseled
the
more or less. They didn't take a hammer and chisel, they just chop it and chop the edges off and get what they need to do. Well, they found out that was a good thing, and then I started taking lunch out for them where they could stay all day. And
what would lunch be?
Well, they cooked their own down there. We didn't cook for them. They had their own cooking.
So mostly, you supplied the raw.
Yeah, we furnished. Yeah, yeah, the groceries for them.
And they did their own cooking.
Yeah, we even bought some sausage for them, and they cooked the sausage.
Okay.
And they made a lot of soups. Rather than being fancy, you know, there was not much meat. There was no meat hardly for us, let alone for anybody else. So, but we ate their cooking. So I got it fixed where they could take their couple of pieces of sausage out and do just like they do. You go to work, you got to be something to eat, and that's it. And that was kind of in the best time of the year. I don't remember exactly, but it was the best time of the year. And we were starting to get close into the cold, cooler weather. Well, then a German sergeant come out. I was on what they call charge of quarters. And that's when you're responsible for different things that has to be done.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I was just checking.
That's all right.
I was just looking at my notes.
That's all right.
But, yeah, go ahead.
And he came out and he wanted to talk to me. He came to the. It's a double. I'm sorry. I'll shut it off. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. That's fine.
Anyway, I said, they asked me if they could go out and work. And I said, well, I don't have nothing for you to work. And I said, but I'll talk to the I'll talk to the captain and see what we can do. I mentioned it to him, and he said, you know, we've been thinking about the same thing, that we need to get them out and work them. And instead of just sitting around or maybe eventually causing a problem. Anyway, they worked it out. They worked it out with these woodcutters. These people like Angelina Lumber, which don't exist anymore, but Angelina Lumber, I think they've done some stuff for Southern Pine. They even done a few things for the paper mill.
Now, not the Huntsville camp. Are you talking about the Huntsville camp sent people over?
I brought them over here.
Oh, you brought them over here.
Yeah,
okay.
They went ahead and got people that had trucks that, you know, that was in the woods. They were doing it in the woods with those trucks anyway, taking cutters and stackers and all of that. And that's what they were going to do. They were going to put some of them with the crews that was going to go in there and cut.
So you drive all the way from Huntsville to Angelina County?
Yeah.
And then drive back that evening?
Yes, sir.
How many hours of work could they get done?
Well, they probably didn't do but about 4 hours anyway, period. That's about all. and maybe not that much. Here's what they did. And you have to forgive me. My memory's going back a long way. They put them in the woods, and they had to do so many pins, they called it, timber pins. And that's a stacking of, I believe, 4x6, 4 foot long, 6 foot high. I may be wrong about the measures. And then they stacked them in there, and that's all they done. They never did anything else. Then if they worked the next day, they loaded the trucks with it. They could take those things and throw it up on it. The way they loaded trucks then, they loaded them into almost a V.
So this pulpwood?
Yeah, pulpwood.
Pulpwood, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And there was some timber also, I mean, that they cut.
Some for boards?
Boards, the longer stuff. They had a longer, at that time, they used mules in there that waddled in the mud and everything else, and they're the ones that pulled the timber logs out further where they could get them. And I think they used the mules to load the wagons, for all I know. I know they got done before we got back out there.
So how many men typically, if there was such a thing as typical, did you bring from Huntsville over here to do like a
We finally wound up with four truckloads.
Four truckloads.
And that would be about 24, 25 in the truck.
Okay.
They put they built a wooden thing over the truck. Like we have a thing on the back of our truck to cover, right? Well, they did the whole truck except the cab, and it was a long wheelbase truck, and that's what they did. They loaded them up in there and brought them over here. And
were these marked army trucks? Were they?
No,
army
it wasn't
trucks?
No marking at
no,
all.
No.
These belonged to individual men that did this for the companies anyway.
Hmm.
And so they contracted, contracted out
with
the government then to haul them eventually over here is what they did.
And you typically carried a shotgun?
Yeah.
As far as being the guard?
Yeah, basically. Well, the shotgun was easy to handle, and not only that, it did the job better.
Did you ever have to use it?
Yeah, once. And
did you shoot to kill or just shoot to warn them or what?
I did kill.
You did?
I'm not proud of it, though. It was when they were rioting over there and
rioting?
They, what they did, they finally, the ones that were hard, just hard Nazi or whatever you want to call them, they decided that they didn't want these men going out to work anymore. And they said it was helping the United States too much. And then they started holding what they called kangaroo court. And if the guy said he was going to go out anyway, they killed them. They would wrap them in a blanket, disconnect the pipes under the latrine, and beat them to death. I think the marker at one time was there. I don't know. I think it's still 30-some-odd they killed.
That's at the Huntsville camp.
Yes.
Huh?
Yeah.
So how? What was the occasion of you using the shotgun? Was it during those episodes?
Well,
or?
They were. We couldn't get them out of the. It was Thanksgiving. I know that like it was in my blood. It was Thanksgiving, and they thought we'd all be gone, so they were going to have a good time, you know. They were going to have fun. They were going to beat up the ones they did, or the ones they wanted to kill. We found three that was dead down there. They hanged, and then they went into the where they do the recreation in the back, and saw the German sergeant come up and tell me what was going on. He said the ones that's supposed to be in compound one. Three is in one. One is in two. They're all mixed up. And so we what was left up in the compound, we made them go back to the back and try and get them to do the right thing and go back to where they were at. And this one guy went into where the one of the buildings. And we went in the building, an officer and myself and two others, and we found the guys under the bed. And when this guy come out of the latrine, he wanted to beat somebody up or do something with him. He had a pipe. And I didn't shoot to kill him. It just happened.
Yeah. How many guards were there per prisoner? I mean, how many?
Well, there was, I think it says 3,000 of them.
3,000 prisoners?
Yeah.
And how many guards did y'all
two have? Companies, there was two companies that were guarding, that's 100 and, it was 151 in one company and 118 the other. We was in 151 GIs. But that's not all guards either.
Not all guards, yeah.
You got cooks and, you know, and everything.
Besides the riots you just described, overall, how was the behavior of the prisoners?
Oh, it was great after that. You know, I am so
that's
sorry.
That's all right. If you need to get it, we can pause it.
Yeah, go ahead and pause it. It's my wife.
Sure, I'll pause it. We're going to pause the recording.
That's how I got into Lufkin.
Okay, we're starting back again.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. You got into Lufkin.
That's how I got to Lufkin, is because all of these things was going on. And they decided then to put a camp in Lufkin where they could work them right out of the camp here and not be driving them all over the place and getting them away from the arrogance of some of that was in that camp. And let the ones that really wanted to work to bring them out and let them work.
Okay. So Lufkin had two camps eventually. What was the first one?
The first one was that one out where the U.S. Forest Service has built their building.
Okay.
Now.
The one where we put the marker.
Yes, sir.
Okay, that was the first
one. And that was the first one. And I think we had 207, I believe, there. And that was then we put them in that concrete building in the back. It was there, but I don't know why it was there. But we cleaned it all up, secured it, and done everything.
And so you were stationed at that camp then?
Well, I came over here, is what I'd done, to open another one. There was two camps in Lufkin. People don't know that.
Yeah.
There was one there where the middle school is now.
Right, yeah. It's where I went to high school. And
is that where you
now
went
now the
to
middle school, right?
Yeah. Well, there was an exhibition buildings there from the old U.S., not U.S., the old Forest Service that they had the Forest Festival there. And then there was a baseball field in the back, too.
That's where the Foresters played, right?
Foresters, okay. Yes, sir.
We'll get into that a little later.
That's where they played.
Okay.
And they changed the name, though, to, I think they changed it to Angels. I may be wrong, but okay. Anyway, so I opened that camp, And it was the Dickens to secure it, though, because those buildings had wide doors on it. We had to get them, where they could sleep in there. We put them on bunk beds and things like that.
Were you in Lufkin during the Normandy invasion, early June of 1944? Were you in Lufkin then?
I don't think so.
Okay. The reason why I was asking is I remember when we did that World War II exhibit in 2005, I think there were three editions of the Lufkin newspaper that day. It was June the 6th.
And yeah.
So there were three editions telling the updates of the Normandy invasion.
Yeah.
And one of them, I can't remember if it was first, second, or third, but on the front page was a little news item where it said that the POWs at the Lufkin camps were on strike.
I wouldn't.
That they refused to work.
Yeah,
they wanted. I can't remember if they wanted more money or less hours or both. But I was just curious if you were here during that.
I think one of the things, and I may be wrong about this, but I think one of the things was that they weren't getting that PX stuff like it was from the Maine. They still didn't have a PX in Lufkin.
Okay, what's a PX?
It's where they can buy stuff, and that's where the guys went to drink their beer and so forth and so on. It's got a name, but I can't think. But anyway, and I think that was really what was happening. I think I remember hearing about it.
Huh.
They sent me to school, I think, about that time. I went to a school over in Georgia.
But you were saying that the ones that came from Huntsville here to
work
was mainly because
they were willing to work
in the woods
and
kind of thing. You want some water here?
No, I'm fine. I'm fine. Yeah, but yes, and
okay.
we took them for granted too much after a while. There was men that were happy to be here. Happy to be pleased that they know that nothing was going to happen to them anymore. And I talked to one or two of them, and we would sit down, and I would try to understand them what they were saying. And if you stay long enough with something like that, and they'll eventually catch on some of the words that you're saying also. And you can communicate with them.
Did y'all have any kind of official interpreters in these units?
No.
Like did each camp have some person?
No. No. We were out there on our own.
I guess that wasn't a priority, with communicating with them.
Well, we had to do that on the trains, We were there on our own. Nothing else. It had to be done. I spent a lot of time on those trains. In fact, you can get sick of the motion of the
mm-hmm,
train,
mm-hmm.
And you'd get off and be through and they marching you somewhere, and you could watch the line. They'd be marching like wiggling all over till they got where they were getting to the trucks to get on. But I went to every state in the United States with prisoners except North Dakota.
Hmm.
That is the only state.
Now, was that before you
this
came
is
to
before,
Lufkin?
Yeah, this
before,
before you
came
yeah. to Lufkin.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
In fact,
when I got to Lufkin, there was already some prisoners there from the first company of men that was here. And some of them started to point to me and some of the other guys, some of the prisoners, and say, Americana, and then they were saying that we brought them there. And we did. We backed the train up, but we didn't stay. We didn't even know where the camp was. We backed the train up, and they come, got them, and they marched them to the prison camp, but we never went there, the prison camp. We were in Trinity. We never got out of Trinity, and then we went back up through St. Louis and back over to New York. Then we went right back where we came from. Am I mixing this thing up for you?
No. You traveled around a good bit, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I mean, I was at every state.
And you were always responsible for the prisoners on the train.
That's right.
And then you would ride back to Staten Island. Is that where most of them came?
They actually came in at Fort Wadsworth.
Okay.
That's where they had them.
And where was that?
I believe that's at the bottom of New York.
Not Staten Island.
Physically.
Yes, Long Island.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there is Staten Island. We were there on Staten Island because that was an airfield, but it was never used anymore since the war. They stopped using it. And we stayed in a hangar. We had bunk beds in a hangar and all over the place. And they cooked in the corner for us because we didn't stay there very long. We'd come in maybe 3 days and we'd go out again.
Take more.
Yeah.
Transfer them all over.
Oh, they were coming in left and right. You got to remember.
So these are only European theater.
Well, these were all from Africa.
Okay.
Everything that I handled was from North Africa.
Okay.
Ramos crack troops. I mean, no question about it. And, what's his name? Two Pistol Annie. He's the one that destroyed him, Patton. I mean, he beat him up. And then Rama left, like I said before. He left and went over to Italy. He left those guys cold. And I think that's where him and Hitler had got crossways. And he stuck them up there in France with nothing. He never did anything much for him. He didn't give him the material. And I think he wanted him dead anyway. An opinion.
Talk a little bit more about your time in Lufkin. Can you describe the barrack, not necessarily the barracks, but just the structures and things as it related to Huntsville? Were they bigger camps than Huntsville, smaller camps?
Oh, no, we were a lot smaller, very small.
Huntsville was a lot larger.
Yeah, and there was camps dotted here and there with very few German men in it. You know, they brought them from... Huntsville was like the headquarters to send them out. And that's basically where they did. I didn't get to see a lot of them that may have switched and went to another camp or whatever because they needed them. I know this. I know what I did from Huntsville to Lufkin. And then also to Center. I went up to Center. And then I went up to Fannin one time. And that was a long trip. It was a long trip, then. It was a 2-lane highway.
There's a photograph here I'm flipping through. There's a photograph here of Mr. Weber. He's in uniform. He's standing up to a microphone.
Oh.
And it says, from campus studio radio, students present programs over station KSAM. What was that about?
That was at the college.
Sam Houston.
Sam Houston, yes. And most of the ones that were there was girls. There was not that many men, but there was young boys there, too. Anyway, they asked if they would come and entertain us. And I went, and I sang for them.
You sang for them, okay.
Yeah.
So that's you singing there at the, over
yes,
the microphone.
Yes, I want you to know I sang very well. You know, I could have been on Broadway. Now you're shaking your head, but I could have.
You could have.
Yes,
okay.
I went over. My mother let me go over there with this lady, and I went over to.
Now you're talking about when you were a child.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was 13, and I went over to Broadway. And this may not be what you want to hear, but anyway, I went over there and. At that time, they were doing what they call curtain call. And it was for the dead-end kids. You probably never heard of them. And it was going to be a play on Broadway. And Ward Bond was going to be in it. Humphrey Bogart was going to be a part of it. And a lady that was a silent screen star. I'll think of it after a little bit. But anyway... And I got picked, and the lady got the contract and took it home to my mother, and my mother said, he ain't going to do that. I'm not going to let him do that. And I could have made two movies. One would have been Going My Way with Bing Crosby. That's not malarkey.
So, but going into the military,
jumped
out then, huh? I mean, that would have been, I guess, late 30s, early 40s that you're talking about.
That's right.
Yeah, about 39, 40?
Yeah.
Okay. I meant to ask you this earlier. Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I did. I had a brother that was an invalid, and I had a younger brother also.
Okay. Did he join the military?
Yes. So my younger brother wound up in the Marines.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you came to Texas.
Yes.
And, serving as a guard here, and then how did you get out of Texas? I think you told me you wound up on Iwo Jima. So how did that happen?
Well, what I did, they sent me to school in Atlanta, Georgia. And I didn't know the big picture at that time. And they said that even though I had some time with the guns and all that, and I had also gone to Camp Abilene, which was it's not there anymore, but it had I forget what division it was, but anyway, it was an armored division. And I had to take the combat training there, true combat. They would stick you in a hole and run a tank over you, see if, and stop over you and see how scared you would be. Anyway, and then they shipped me to Atlanta from there, and it was school. They were trying to get us to know enough about medicine in case, and I didn't even know I was going to the Pacific then, in case of we had to invade Japan. They wanted combat medics is what they wanted. And I went to school there, graduated from Oglethorpe in 90 days, and then they sent me to Kennedy General in Memphis, Tennessee, and I did some more training, medical training, and got my certificate, went back to Abilene, and they said, we're shipping you out. And I hooked up with an outfit in Fort Lewis, Washington. And I was there about a day and a half. And they come in, they said, no, we're loading you up, you're going to the Pacific. And that's where I wound up going. I went to the Pacific, and
What division were you in then?
I was just hooked to this company, and I was going to be reassigned when I got to wherever they were going.
Okay.
And took me to Hawaii, and there was army guys that was on there, but they got off, and I didn't get off. And then when they came back, there was other guys getting on there. I asked them where they were going. They said, we have no idea. We don't know. And I said, well, okay. And I got on that ship, and the first place I went was, not combat, but Aniwetok. And I don't know whether that's the island they blew up with the atom bomb or not. They tested one on an island, Aniwetok, Kwajalein. I think it was Kwajalein, I'm not sure. Went there, and Tinian. And then I got off on Saipan because they got off. And I stayed down on the beach, mostly close to the beach. And then the beach commander come by and said, oh, you army guys that's here. There's about 38 of us, I think. Said, you're going to get on the, they're going to bring Higgins boats in, and you're going to go out and get on the ship. And I said, okay. I did. And when I got out there, they're all Marines. And I said, hey, where are you guys going? And they said, well, really don't know. Maybe to the Philippines. I said, man, that'd be good duty because the Philippines was kind of cleaned up already, you know. And anyway, we left, and we had a slight attack by a submarine, which was not true. I mean, it was one of ours. It surfaced, and they thought it was something. Anyway, and I said, man, this is wild. And
Why do you think a few Army personnel were attached to the Marines?
Well, I can tell you.
Okay.
When we got there, we had a transfer to an LCM opened up in the front. And anyway, they did that. They run at the beach, and the guy, who's ever run that boat, he forgot to put the anchor down when it was supposed to be way out there. He dropped it, but he didn't drop it right, and so it was like about hit of the wall to the beach for me. So then they decided that they'd go in on threes. Anyway, I got there, and there was a beach commander, and we were sitting on the beach, and he said, what are you guys doing here? And I said, I don't know. They told me to come up here, and I'm here. And he said, are you the only non-com? And I said, no, there's four of us, I think, maybe five. And he said, well, we're going to have to do something with you. And I said, all right. And he said, I'm going to hook you up with the 4th Marine Division. And I said, and what's that mean? He said, well, but you'll be attached but unassigned. And I said, okay. And he said, have you got any papers on you? And I said, no, I don't have anything. It's just that I'm supposed to get on that boat, be here. Anyway, he come the next day and he said, well, you guys is here for a reason. And I said, well, I'm hoping I am. I didn't want to come here for nothing. And I said, this is not a nice place, is it? He said, no, it's not. But anyway, we were there to, they were going to, as soon as they took the airstrip, they were going to go ahead and bring the B-29s that was limping all over the place. You know, they were having to ditch in the water, every one of them, because there was no place for them to land. They couldn't get back to Saipan, which was the base of all the B-29. And our job was to protect them when they came in and to protect if they were going to go out again. We had ammunition there for them. We had oil and gas dumps for them. And they had their own crews that would do it. But we were supposed to protect all of that was there. And I think we'd done a good job. But they still had the ditch in the water because the airstrip that they really needed for the CBs to redo, and that there were CBs there, they didn't get it long enough, and so they had to wait. So they did continue to ditch for about a week, maybe two, maybe just about a week. And then they said, well, we're going to start bringing them in. That night, we had a little banzai charge and after us, and I was in with two other Marines, and they said, just keep your head down, you're going to be all right. Anyway, and you got the diary?
No, sir.
This is something you really need. And you have this, though, where the temporary guard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And this is where, this is a meritorious service. that. I don't know whether you have that or not.
I don't think we have
that. That's me. Let me get this. Here we go. This is very interesting, and you might want to make copies of this. And these, by the way, these things, there's the B-29s, and this you got.
Yeah, I think we have a copy of that.
Well, I'm gonna get down to these if you don't mind. And this, you got the temporary guard too, don't you?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay. All right, let me get that.
Okay, so you're at the 232nd General Hospital.
No, that's what I was protecting.
You were protecting.
Yes, sir. I was there for him.
Well, says
I was
here,
actually.
Says here you were a member of the 232nd General Hospital, Iwo Jima Volcano Islands.
Yeah.
When you got the Meritorious Service Unit.
Well, it came through them because I was not assigned to anybody.
Okay.
And this is when I was young. This is my wife that died, but that's when I was young.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's nice. Yeah, we'll have to get a copy of this.
And this, you're welcome to if you can use it. This I carried on the island.
A little flag, huh?
And look, 48 states.
Yeah, 48 state flag, yeah. Small.
Yeah, that's small. That's what you carried on.
You just carried it.
Yeah.
With you.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And if you have any reason for it, you're welcome to it. It will never get used anyway.
All right. Yeah, we'll definitely like to get a copy of your. So is this a little journal that you kept? You wrote this?
No. I took that off of. I keep saying these things. I don't want to. I may sound like I'm bragging. I killed him. And I'm going to read that. And that I got it interpreted. I didn't know what I had. I had no idea. And I think the guy that interpreted is his name Greenwood, Green something.
Lieutenant Goldberg?
Goldberg. Well, I was close. Green, gold gets green or whatever.
Okay, so
yeah,
so this
he
was
interpreted.
This was a Japanese soldier's
diary. Yeah,
okay.
This is his. From us to what he sees of us.
Okay. So a Japanese soldier wrote this, and then you had someone translate it.
Well, it was a book.
Oh, okay.
And I got the book. I had no idea what he had. And I said, I'd like to know what it is, you know. And they said, well, you'll have to go down on the beach, and maybe they can tell you if there's an interpreter out on one of the ships.
Yeah.
You can make copies of those.
Okay,
in the thing.
Yes. So were you actually on Iwo Jima during the fighting?
Yeah.
Okay.
It wasn't over. You know, I wasn't on the invasion. Don't misunderstand.
Okay.
No, but you know. That
it was late February, I believe, wasn't it? '45.
When they finished it up.
Late February through early March.
They invaded on February 19th.
February 19th.
Okay. Yeah, and on '45, and the thing is, the Marines had a it was. You know, if when you get reading that, you'll have a better understanding. Of what went on, they bombed these people constantly for months, almost three months they bombed them
before the invasion.
Yeah, it didn't do any good. I think 18,000 Marines got wounded or dead, and I believe something like 20 some odd thousand Japanese died on that island under the ground. That's a lot. Just think, that's 8 square miles. Mm-hmm. That's all it is.
So how long were you there on Iwo?
Probably about 2.5 weeks, something like
okay.
that.
Okay.
I wasn't there very long.
Did you ever come back to Texas as a guard again, or
no?
That was the end.
No, when I got hurt, they took me out of the service.
How did you get hurt? You said you got hurt.
Yeah, well,
injured.
Yeah, it was in the anti-personnel shrapnel that I got hit with.
Okay.
You know, I got it here, stuck in here, and then my
right
leg,
eye,
and my leg, and of course the eye is gone now,
okay.
And it lasted a little while, but not very long.
Was that on Iwo Jima?
Yeah.
When that happened?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They brought me home and I landed in California, and they were fixing up a medical train to take it, go east. And they put me on it, and dumped me in the hospital when I got there.
So you went all the way back to New York then?
Well, you have
okay.
to, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
If you're going to get out, and actually, at that time, if you had so many points, you can get out anyway. You didn't have to be walking wounded or anything else. It depended on time and service,
mm-hmm.
and time on foreign soil, and medals that you had, and if you'd been wounded, you got out. And that doesn't mean they kicked you out. I mean it was up to you. And when I went right back to the same camp, which is they turned into a hospital, of what I went out of, this Camp Upton,
okay.
And I stayed there, I think maybe 2 months, in the hospital off and on, and then they came around and said you can go out if you want to, and I said boy do I, and. They said, well, you're going to have to wait till we figure out how much medical you're going to need. And then maybe when you go out, you can go to one of the hospitals and the government will pay for it and all of that. And about 10 days later, they came and they said, well, we're going to try and keep you. And I said, how long? He said, well, till we get things settled, you know, what we need to do with you physically. And I said, I don't want to stay. And they said, well, the only way you can go out now is AMA. And I went AMA.
And what is that?
Against medical advice.
Okay. So how did you get to Texas? When and how?
Well, you know, I was here.
You had such a good time down here, huh?
Yeah. Well, you know, I liked it. You know, I was a city boy that when I went back, I had met a girl here, and I asked
Lufkin
her.
Lufkin?
Yeah, Lufkin.
Okay.
Yeah. And I asked her to meet me in New York. I wanted to marry her. And she said, okay. And she met me.
Who was that?
She's dead now. It's the one that's in that picture.
Yes. What was her name?
Bowles. Her maiden name was Bowles.
Bowles, okay.
Yeah.
How did you meet her? Just in
I went to town several times when I was here.
Okay.
But there was nothing for us, don't misunderstand. And then we also had to do duty on the bus. The buses that came in, if they had GIs on it, we had to check passes and dog tags, make sure the dog tags matched up with the pass, that they weren't AWOL or something.
Oh, okay, okay.
We had to do that. We did that.
In addition to guarding
the German POWs, you would do
military police at the bus stop.
That's right.
And stuff.
Well,
okay.
We did it in town, period.
Right.
But, you know. And anyway, she was a... This leg gets a little cramped every now and then.
Sure.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, lean back or...
No, it's all right. It just does it every now and then. But anyway, she agreed. And,
you can set it up in that chair if you'd
no,
like.
No, I'm fine. I'm all right. And I worked in New York for...
So y'all were married in New York then?
Married. And I worked in New York for maybe 8 months. And I had to belong to the union. And I didn't like that. I still got my card, though, where I said...
What kind of work was it?
Well, I was sitting on a truck, Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer.
Okay.
And I'd go up to Yankee Stadium, and we'd unload the beer up there in about 3 hours, and I'd come back, and I had the day off, the rest of the day off, and I did that every morning. And one day, we went there, and the doors was closed. And I said, what are we doing? What's going on? And they shut us out, and they were going to shut us out and move the plant to Jersey. And so I said, well, I ain't going to do this. I'm going to go down in Texas. And
go
see
to
what,
Texas, huh?
Yeah. So we had a baby about that time, and I packed them up, came down to Lufkin, had no place to live. Lived with her brother for a little while, went to work for Coca-Cola plant, and loved this. It was a new life. I loved it. I still love it. With all that there is, I loved it. And I'd work for Coca-Cola a while, and then I went to work for Angelina Chevrolet, sold cars. Became the big boy in it and did very well. And then I decided that I needed to do something else. So I went in the insurance business. And I sold it out after 22 years. And I also had the bowling alley, sold it.
That Lufkin Lanes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that. How long were you involved with that?
About 4 years.
Was Murphy Martin connected
with
that?
Oh, do you know Murphy?
A little bit.
He lived next door to us on Ellis Avenue.
Okay.
His daddy was one that also worked at the Coca-Cola plant. And so did his uncle. I knew Murphy real well.
How was he connected with the bowling alley? What was he? Or,
no, he was a radio announcer, and he had gone to Dallas and lived, and then I was in New York, and he also went to New York with ABC.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He was the anchor up there.
Yeah, and I visited with him, and when I was just visiting up there, and. I knew him real well, real well. Anyway, he was a good guy.
So, but you were the owner of the bowling alley then,
yes,
huh?
Yeah,
okay.
So, yeah. And that was because of Arthur Temple. He's the one that took care of me.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he was just a nice man. He was a good man. And we were in the JCs together.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's a long time ago. I think he's only about 3 years older than me, if he's that much.
Yeah, I think he was born in 20.
Yeah, something like
April,
that. Yeah, 20. We were in the JCs together, and we were just kicking it off. The war had destroyed everything, and they wanted to start over it again. And a guy by the name of Gus Bush, did you remember? You know that?
The name, yes.
Yeah, and all of us, we started the JCs. And you get close to people.
So Mr. Temple, how did he help you with the bowling alley?
Well, he owned the building.
He owned the building. Okay.
And they told me that they hadn't been able to pay for the building, pay it. And he said, you just let me know when you can. And that's what I done.
So you managed the bowling alley?
I stayed, and I bowled, too.
You bowled, too?
Yeah.
Okay.
And my first wife, we all did it.
So how many years did you do that, the bowling alley?
About four.
About 4 years. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Do y'all have any notable bowlers come through the area and bowl there?
Yeah. There was a guy, Weber, Dick Weber.
Dick Weber.
Yeah. I think he was, yeah. In fact, he was national champ for years.
Okay.
Yeah.
No relation to you, huh?
No. Spelt the same, no.
Okay, 1B.
Yeah, 1B.
Okay.
Then I went up to Chicago, to Brunswick, and we had 24 lanes, and I told them that it was not profitable to have 24 lanes in Lufkin at that time. So I told him I was going to take 12 out, and I could either give them back to them, or they can help me sell them, and they helped me sell them. So, and I put pool tables in there then, alongside of them.
So was it ever doing good with 24 lanes?
Oh, it's just it didn't do that well. It was a struggle constantly. You know, it was a burst of everybody going there, you know, and you'd have to wait for lanes and all that kind of stuff. And and the guys that own it, did you know Benton Musselwhite?
I know the name.
Yeah. Him and Fred Benes from SMU, that's the ones that really started to get into it.
And that was right after the war?
No, that was in 1960.
Oh, okay, much later.
Yeah.
But I mean, when you were involved with it, how close to the end of the war was that?
I wasn't involved in it. I had already had my insurance agency.
Oh, okay, you're talking about.
Yeah, and worked for the Coca-Cola plant, right out. That's where that was after the war.
What years were you involved with the bowling alley? Approximately.
Well, I can almost tell you. Let's see, Kennedy was killed when I
63.
Had it.
63?
Yeah.
In there? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess my question, I'm not really sure when the bowling alley began. Was it?
Well, it wasn't started by me. It was started by Benton and them.
Okay.
And they got Arthur to build the building on that property, which he owned the property.
So in the 50s, or?
No, it was... I took it after about a year and a half.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, it was all jumbled up.
Okay, they were wanting out. To the end of the war.
Yeah, they were wanting out.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about your days with baseball and softball. I think Angeline Chevrolet was a sponsor of a team or two, or maybe even a league.
Yeah.
Didn't they build a softball field?
No, we had what they called WOW,
the Woodmen
of the World.
Okay.
And they had, it was their field. And
now, where was that located? Wasn't that near the bowling alley?
Yeah, in fact, the bowling alley was the backside of the field.
Okay.
You know where that, what is that shopping center? Chestnut Shopping Center?
Yeah, that area over there, yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, if you go almost to the street, because it was a dirt road there. It wasn't like it is now.
Right.
So if you backed up almost to that street, that's where the stands and that were where people sat. And then the home plate was up. And then the next thing you seen was the old Panther Drive-In. You could say that from there.
Okay.
And... we had as much as 3,000 people out there watching those games.
Yeah, Roscoe Ivey's told me about that was some really good participation.
He was a fine ball player. He was actually one of the best, believe me. I had him for a while. I don't know whether, I forget why we split up. I think he was wanting to go where he worked or something. They had a team and he promised he'd do that. But,
he was telling me, too, about how air conditioning and television kind of ruined all that because people used to get out more and would come and watch a baseball game, and when air conditioning and television came along, people inside.
I built about three or four houses, and I say I did. Arthur would say, hey, I want to build you a house. I'm not making this up. He said, I want to get this started, that addition, you know, like the one that was on Atkinson Drive. And back in there, that was his addition, him and R.B. Thompson and Billy Lee, and whether you know those names or not. But anyway, and he said, I want to build a house in there for you. And I said, okay, where? He said, on Chambers Street. I said, all right. He built it for me, and I think my payments was $38 a month. And I said, well, this is good stuff. So I went to him, and I said, I want to build another house. He said, where? And I said, well, I don't know yet. He said, well, you find out, I'll get Billy Lee and them to take care of you. And I did. I built another house on, actually on Pershing, over by the Lufkin Industries on the backside. Anyway, and then later on I told him I want to build another house, and I built it on Randolph, only two houses on there. You know where Randolph is? Well, RB's son's name is Randy, and that's where it came up with the Randolph. Anyway, it's behind the Memorial Hospital.
Okay. Talk a little about that time period of sort of semi-pro, I guess it was semi-professional league, right?
Yeah, the baseball.
Yeah. Just talk about that. What was that all about? You know, we don't have that today. So tell.
Well,
tell the people today.
It was financed to come here by, I believe, several men. I don't think Arthur was involved at that time. Arthur was working in the lumber yards. He wasn't president yet of anything. But I think the curse and that fixed it where that could be. And the field was built just like I told you about, back behind all those exhibit buildings. And they played Tyler, Beaumont, maybe I think Austin. It wasn't a local thing where they could just have a league locally. They'd done real well, but it was never a profitable thing. People, didn't want to go out there and sit in the heat and all that kind of stuff.
Roscoe told me, I asked him, what does semi-professional mean? And he said, well, it meant that if you had enough money left over after paying for your gas to go travel... and your other expenses.
If you had
enough to buy a hamburger, you were doing good.
He's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly what you had to do.
And he explained, you know, the winners usually got a certain percentage and the losers got, you know, less of a percentage.
Yeah.
But that would be the proceeds from the sales of the tickets spectators.
The boys that I had, the Dirty Sox.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, they were part of a baseball team of the school.
Okay.
And but they wanted to make some money. So I said, well, I don't know where we can do it. And you know, there's a community called Nigton.
Mm-hmm. And, or in Trinity County.
Yeah. And that was their biggest thing. They liked to play baseball over there. And boy, they had some guys that could throw the ball and hit the ball. Well, we'd go over there, we'd put a little money in the pot, you know, maybe as much as $20, and that's a lot of money. And we put that money, we'd go over there and play them. And sometimes we'd win, sometimes we'd lose.
Is this baseball or softball?
No, this is baseball.
Baseball.
Everything was baseball.
And this was the
now,
dirty
we
soft?
Played softball, where you're talking about over there with the WOW.
Right.
That was not baseball.
Right.
That was softball.
Is this the Dirty Sox we're talking about?
Dirty Sox,
okay,
yeah.
And that was a baseball team.
And that was a baseball team.
You
was
were
my
a
baseball
manager?
Team. Yeah, that okay. was my baseball team.
Did you play also?
Yeah, I'm just fixing to get to that. Yes, I played right field
right
in
field.
Softball, but I didn't play much in the baseball.
Okay.
But anyway, I played, and I went over there, and we only had nine guys, and so we wanted to go over to Nagton and play him because they had 200 and some odd bucks they wanted to use. Well, we didn't have that kind of money. Anyway, went over there and I managed the guys and I put them where they wanted to and all that. Got down to the very end and we were already getting clobbered. I mean, we couldn't have won it if God had got us on base, we couldn't have. But anyway, and so I got up to bat. And I hit it hard, and I hit it over the second baseman's head, and I ran. And I was just having a good time, and I slid into second base, and I broke my leg.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I sure did. They didn't want to move me. I mean, it was just broke.
Dangling, huh?
Yeah, and it broke both bones, you know. And anyway, and so they would go to me in the car, and they were taking me back to the hospital to get something done to it. And, man, I was saying, I hurt. And all of a sudden I heard, whack! And the guy by the name, Ray Jaro, he whacked me and knocked me out. I was out for about 10 minutes or longer. But they were rough. They were rough kids.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't that much older than them either.
Now, Angeline Chevrolet sponsored a team, right?
Yeah.
Your employer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure. I worked for them.
Did they sponsor the Dirty Sox?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the one they did. I put it together. I put the Dirty Sox together. And before that...
And what years would that have been? Early 50s or late 40s?
It was in the 50s.
50s, okay.
Yeah. And before that, I managed another team. You ever heard of Ralph New Oldsmobile?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, I managed their team for them before that. And then they kept saying, hey, we want to get a team going, and we need you to come get some money for us and that. And so I told the guys I was going to leave and put another team together.
Yeah. So y'all played the baseball, y'all played at Forrester Park then?
No, that's where the
Foresters played.
Yeah, that's okay. Where they played. No, we didn't play there. We played at the school.
At the high school?
High school,
High school games, okay.
Yeah. That's it.
Did the school know about y'all betting and gambling?
No. No, they didn't. Now, most of those guys had young ladies, too. They had girls.
But they were out of school, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you couldn't do that if you were in school.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Puss Irwin. Did you ever heard know him?
Who?
Puss Irwin.
Irwin?
Yeah. Puss Irwin,
no,
coaching.
Not really.
Coach in Lufkin. Well, he's the one that was their baseball coach.
So you had a long insurance career then, and
yes, I did.
How did you get to do what you do now? You're a courier now for the bank.
Yeah.
And
Go
back to your POW guard days?
No. What happened is that Pony Express wanted to spread out. They were all in Houston and mostly along Interstate 10 and that.
Now, what is Pony Express? You mean Wells Fargo?
No.
What are you talking
Pony
about?
Express, that's it. The Pony Express name itself. And
what is that?
Well, they would deliver stuff. They would deliver stuff like FedEx and
okay,
that.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. And so they needed somebody up here, so I went down and interviewed, and they said, well, what kind of a car do you have? Because we want you to use your own car. And I said, I got a van. Anyway, I've started building routes for them. I went as far as Tyler. And that was good territory. Then I went all up through Timpson and all the way over to Tenehaw, Joaquin, came down into St. Augustine, and made all those different areas. And I got them, I think the total was 38 banks.
Just First Bank and Trust? Or
no, the First Bank and Trust never entered into it except one bank, and that was Dybal.
Okay.
They didn't have those branches they have now. These are all since I've started.
Okay.
And I got them, I think it was maybe 42 different stops. And I worked it myself for a while. And then one day after 3 years, they called and they said, you're going to have to bring your own work in to the feds. We were picking up and delivering work for the Federal Reserve. to the banks.
Okay.
And they said, well, you're going to bring it in yourself. So I said, okay. And they said, stop here at the office. Went down, knocked on the door of the office. Nobody would answer. I said, I wonder what the heck's going on. In a few minutes, guy opened the door. And he said, Ben, they're closing up. They're going to take bankruptcy.
Which bank was that?
No, bankruptcy.
The company.
That was the whole company.
Okay.
And I said, well, they owe me money. And he said, well, they're going to take bankruptcy. You probably won't never get it. Anyway, so I came home and I came back, and the next morning, I was in the bank.
Here in Dibble?
Yeah. And I said, I'm going to ask them, see what they want to do. So Jay was in his office, and I asked him, I knocked on the thing, and I said, can I come in and talk to you? And he said, yeah, come on. He said, I've been wanting to talk to you. He said, what are we going to do about all of this? I said, it's what I'm here for. And he said, what do you mean? I said, I'll do your work. I'll do everything that I can do. And instead of doing service work, I took on the banks. And it was very profitable, as far as I'm concerned. And that's what I did. And then I started hiring people because it became such a burden. I'd be doing it till sometimes 1 o'clock in the morning. I'd have to get it down to the reserve, the Federal Reserve, and maybe I didn't get there till 10 o'clock. And
where was that?
That's in Houston.
Houston.
It was. It's not anymore. They've moved it to Dallas now. There's a Federal Reserve, but you can't do the stuff that I was doing with them. And that's what I done. That's how I got started. And he said, you want any more banks? And I said, yeah, I'll take some more. He said, well, we're going to grow. And he said, you stay with me, we're going to grow. And we got 14 of them now. And there's going to be more. And that's how I really got into it. And I don't know whether Arthur had anything much to do with it. He, you know, he was alive and he was kicking in that day. He wasn't all boogied up like he was in the later years, you know. He'd call me and I'd go down, sit and talk to him. And he'd talk about God and everything else. I have the deepest respect to this day for him. If there's a man that's been on this earth that done so much, I don't think he ever realized how much he really did for people, especially me. I mean that.
Well, Mr. Weber, I think I've asked most all the things that I had, at least, is there anything that you would like to add before we wrap this up?
Well, of course.
Is there anything I forgot to ask or omitted? Well, I want to get your photograph before you leave, too.
I'm very proud of I'm proud of what I've accomplished. A little old nothing from New York, on the streets in New York, didn't have much to eat half the time. It wasn't because my mother didn't try it. There wasn't anything for us.
Yeah.
And, I'm proud of it. I'm proud of Lufkin. I'm proud that they accepted people like me, you know, didn't mistreat me in any way, and gave me the opportunities that they gave me. And, you know, I went to school in Lufkin also. I went to Piney Woods Business School. I did everything I could do to make myself that they'd want me in this town for business or want me to work for them or something. And it worked. I'm very fortunate. And I'm very fortunate to be able to sit here at my age and tell you that I work every day. And my record of my service is one of the things that allows me to sit here, because it taught me to take care of myself. Am I preaching now?
No. So I want to give you the opportunity.
Yeah, that's what I feel like. And it could never... I know there's some bad people in this world, but there's, Lufkin is the most wonderful place that I could have ever sat down and ate breakfast and supper and went to bed in.
Well, thank you again, Mr. Weber. I sure appreciate it.
I hope I ain't been too lousy.
No. I'll go ahead and turn this off then.